coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK.
Worth doing badly.
Welcome to Worth Doing Badly as we remember Holy Week and look forward to celebrating the resurrection of our Lord this coming Sunday. And it is the lessons for this Sunday that David Weber and Ethan Stoppenhagen are going to look at today. And they are Isaiah 65 verses 17 to 25, Psalm 16, 1 Corinthians 15 verses 19 to 26, and Luke 24 verses 1 to 12. We begin with David Weber.
Ethan, I got stuck on the detail of Luke's report of the resurrection when he begins on the first day of the week at early dawn. And the reason I got stuck is that it seemed like not an unimportant detail for Luke. And of course, the church picks this up and says because of the resurrection, worship takes place on Sunday, first day of the week. But the addition of at early dawn is not, I don't think, unimportant, but it also, this is somewhat speculative. So are you ready for a bit of speculation here?
I am.
Okay. I have to introduce a form of poetry called the obad, A-U-B-A-D-E. It contrasts with the serenade. An obad is a lover's poem that is said in the morning. So for some reason, the morning is important to lovers, especially it's a time when they bid farewell to each other. The beloved departs. But in this case, the angel is not really writing poetry, but talking about where the beloved is, and the beloved has departed, but as we know, he's only departed from the grave so that his he can be really present in a permanent sense. So I think Luke is giving us a clue here. Now, of course, he's not writing poetry. The word obad hadn't been created at this time. I don't even know if there was that kind of poetry. It's from the courtly love in the 12th century and all that. All right. Are you sleeping yet?
My eyes are getting heavy. So.
Okay, so obviously this is not anything that is going to be in a sermon. It is something which I just want to ask is why was it important? First day of the week, early dawn, and obviously because a resurrection is changing our experience of time. Now, how is it changing our experience of time? There is a famous poem called The Obad by Philip Larkin. Now, if you know anything about Philip Larkin, probably he's not going to get sentimental about anything. He is ironic and critical and somewhat melancholic, all right? So he writes a song about obad, but turns it on his head. So here's how his goes. Now, nothing worse than hearing poetry in a sermon, but I'm going to give it to you anyway. He said, here's what happens with the morning light. It doesn't reveal love. It doesn't reveal happiness. It reveals what's really always there. And he goes on, what's really always there? Unresting death, a whole day nearer now. Slow light strengthens, and what we know, have always known, that we can't escape. You can't, and yet we can't accept it. All right, well, that is pretty straightforward, and I think that contrasts with the resurrection, is that time has been switched, and unresting death is not a day nearer. Unresting death has died, and what is unfolding one day at a time is our movement towards immortality, which is what every love poem wants, that the love and the lovers live forever. All right, so that has given my understanding of the resurrection, especially the angelic part on the announcement of the resurrection and the implications beginning. It has given a bit of a boost here. So mortality has been swallowed up by immortality. And we can say that over and over again. I mean, it's what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15, which we get a portion of today. So from this point on, the angel is announcing everything has changed, and the rest of a person's life, the rest of life in this mortal existence, is learning to have confidence that Christ's resurrection has actually changed the conditions of our mortal life. Anything to add to that?
I'm wondering, and this just goes with the whole passage of time. I've noticed this, you notice this back in creation too, that it's always evening and then morning. You know, that's sort of the way time gets kept in the Bible. So do you think that plays in here?
Well, I think all of the very poetic analogies on that, our experience of time is going to be where the truth of the resurrection is one of the places that the truth of the resurrection is going to be experienced. We know that if you don't have a resurrection to look forward to, the unfolding of time, as Larkin says, it creates anxiety and despair. Death is one day closer. But what if that has been all reversed? What happens to your moment-by-moment experience of time? And the angel makes it quite clear. Everything has changed. And it's using kind of poetic metaphor here. The women come, Luke notices, with aromatic spices, right? They come to cover the scent of decay. The angel says to them, the cover-up is over. Now the spices, the incense, mean something different. You don't get rid of incense. Incense are now not the smell of death, but they are the smell of a life that we are moving towards. There is a hint of that life, and it hits us like the smell. Now, in my church, it's not my church, but the church I go to uses incense. It's part of the Lord's Supper ritual, and you can see the incense being lit, and then about 5 minutes later, you can smell it. So the reality is that we're coming into the presence of God, and you can just smell that reality. So I like the way that the church has picked up on this. The incense are now the smell of life and not the smell of death.
Yeah, there's definitely rich symbolism there. And that's what, you know, that prompts the question for me, this symbolism that gets transformed, how do we make that seem significant to folks in the pew?
I think the reason for it, we've talked a lot about this, the reason why you have ritual rather than just having a schedule of events, right? A master of ceremony, the reason why you have colors and all of the other thing which look out of place in the modern world, right? And we have people who don't like, people in our church who don't like the ritual and would just as soon get rid of the robes and everything because for some reason it seems inauthentic. Until you realize that a mystery is unfolding here, and a mystery by definition cannot be put into words. Well, what if you are tasked with communicating a mystery, but you recognize that words are going to be inadequate? Well, St. Paul continually uses the word mystery, and he uses a lot of words, but he also makes it quite clear that there is the experience. The words are one thing, but then you go into life and actually are forced to experience the truth. And here's how the first witnesses of the resurrection experience it. The angel asks, why do you seek the living among the dead? And the answer is, we just are not used to dead things living. We are mortal. The word mortal means death. It means that we have grown accustomed to the cover-up. We have grown accustomed to disguising the fact that we are always one day closer to death, until we have a poet like Philip Larkin, saying, your faith is irrelevant unless it actually gives us a cure for death. And so the angel, I just love the way this is, the angel gets to the point, doesn't scold, doesn't shame, asks a question. Why are you seeking life among dead things? Why is it? And from this point on, everyone who believes in the resurrection is tasked with seeing that life comes from the living and not from the dead, having confidence that the resurrection has in fact started a grand reversal in which death itself dies, and learning not to trust dying things, right? So mortal life is not life. Mortal life is a sickness unto death, even when it is at its best. And we can say that over and over again, but it's not until we are actually experiencing our mortality, experiencing the fact that life is receding, death is gaining traction, and that is despairing. So the other side of the sermon, the news preaching the sermon, is actually being by people's side when mortality becomes a reality. Oh, yeah. Gosh, that's a terrible sentence. I like it, though.
So it's good. And that's very, very helpful. You can't articulate the symbolism or the ritual. It just has to be experienced, and like you said, even experienced in the worst ways too.
All right, now here's the key. This is the key for sermon, where the sermon begins. Their response to the angel's question was that they remembered his words, right? Mm-hmm. And they remembered their unbelief at those words, which is implied there, and the movement of time changed that unbelief into belief. And then they get the chance to see it all take place over and over again when they reported these events. The rest of the disciples who hadn't seen it, the words seemed like an idle tale, like babbling, like nonsense, and they did not believe them. But those who told them says, we'll give it time, right? And that's what I think is the greatest confidence in the resurrection is, you can say, we'll give it time, or as Paul says, love is patient, right? It's not that we're going to come up with something. It's that over time, experience is going to actually give us the opportunity to see to experience what the resurrection actually has changed. And Luke just, kind of as a minimalist reporter then says, they returned from the tomb, right? And I was joyful. But now begins life after Easter. Jesus is the way to immortality. Immortality is not just a wish fulfillment. It is actually where the movement of time is headed. So what we have is, life now, the terms of life have now been changed. Life is not meant to be the place where we get the most out of life. Life is this place where we experience the truth of the resurrection in the worst parts of life. That's what St. Paul is so clear that he does his best writing when he's responding to the things that are going wrong. On Easter, I would give a very short sermon just to remind them that there's a whole lot more to be said about it. If I go 15 minutes or 20 minutes, I can't even scratch the surface. So just enjoy the fact that the angel has announced, get ready, because everything has changed. We move on to the psalm. And in the psalm, again, I got stuck on just one passage. In the first part of the psalm, it says, my good is only through you. Now, Ethan, from any basic introduction to Greek philosophy and to Plato, the three things that Plato thought that outlived mortality were beauty, truth, and goodness, right? Mm-hmm. Or what would become to say the good. And then the psalmist doesn't pick up Plato, this is prior to Plato, but the psalmist says, my good is only through you. Now, I remember being ridiculed by people who would say, oh, so you're saying as a Christian, there is no good apart from being a Christian. And that's not at all. What it does say is that in believing in the resurrection, you have a different definition of good. And that good depends solely on God's intervention in getting us beyond mortality. It doesn't mean to say that that which the good that dies is not really good. And in fact, the resurrection will make it make this life's good even more important. So that's part of the whole thing. What do you call good? What do you call desirable? What do you call the thing in life that you want? Well, that's the good. And if that isn't connected to the resurrection, if the good that Christians choose is no different than the good that everyone chooses, then our good is a mortal good. And quite frankly, that is not good enough. That's the problem of the resurrection, is that it taught us that the good should always be something that gains momentum, that grows, moves towards fulfillment. And that means the good is always desiring the eternal. And if it turns out not to be eternal, that is a definition of the sad. So the psalmist says, let their sorrows abound. And I see a bit of an irony in there. Ethan, have you ever noticed that the greater the good that you've enjoyed, the greater the loss that you experience when that person or thing is gone?
Yes.
So in a sense, and when Augustine says this in Book 4, he is just shattered by the death of a friend. And he even says, I am not going to have any more friendships. The friendships are way too hard because they end. I know people who have said, I am never going to have a dog again, because the dog, when the dog dies, it leaves such a hole, if it's a good dog, right? So what the resurrection does is say, is make it very clear that you are here to enjoy the good in its deepest sense. And that means that Christians are committed to suffering the loss of the good and suffering in despair. That's why I think that what Lent is so important. It's saying that this stuff is not meaningless. This is where meaning is taking place in Jesus' movement towards the cross. The cross is not nothing. The cross is the where Jesus is deprived of life and the world is deprived of Jesus, and the sadness of that and the sorrow is as deep as any kind of sadness. It's the lifelong love that is lost. And so what the resurrection is actually asserting is that those who love God's creatures and his creation, they will suffer the loss more powerfully. And the only way you can suffer the sorrow of the crucifixion is if there is the promise of the resurrection. And not a thin promise of the resurrection, but is the one thing that makes all the difference. And the psalm ends by saying, here, I will reject every provisional good. I will not pour their libations of blood. The psalmist says he will not allow himself to trust any good that isn't an eternal good. And then he returns back to where he started. The Lord is my portion and lot, because he sustains me. He is the inheritance. And we talk about bless the Lord. It's always puzzled me in our liturgy where we bless the Lord. I would think the Lord is one person who doesn't need to be blessed. And the phrase actually means that all blessings come from the Lord. All good eventually has its origin and end in the Lord. And that when we bless the Lord, we are just acknowledging what the psalmist says in the beginning, my good comes from that. Now, here's what I said. That when you really see how good the created good is, you are setting yourself up for despair when it dies. The psalmist says, but here is the promise. We will abide secure. The Lord will keep us from Sheol. The Lord will keep us out of the pit. Mortality is now a path of life, and though it experiences the emptiness and sorrow of death, it does not experience it in any kind of permanent sense.
That's what Isaiah gives us, right? The new heavens and the new earth.
Yeah, the new heavens and the new earth. And we're moving right along here. And at the heart and center of this poem is the claim, they shall not labor in vain or bear children for calamity. And you can hear echoes of the creation curse, right? Eve was cursed with labor pains, and Adam was cursed with the pain of labor. And those two signs were the feeling of futility. In Ecclesiastes, futility is having, you know, 9 months of having carried a child and labor, and then you give birth to wind. What we desperately desire is that our lives begun actually have end in fulfillment. This is just every college student puts this bit of nonsense on the wall. It's not the destination, but the journey that matters. That's ridiculous. According to Isaiah, that's like saying it doesn't matter if you build a house but don't live in it, or if you plant a vineyard and never enjoy the fruit, or that you wish for a baby but you don't really care if you experience the rest of that child's life. What we want is, when we start something, we want to get it to the end, and that is the resurrection. Jesus, in claiming to be the way, is the way towards this fulfillment, the way out of this life, the way into this teleological fulfillment. And as you say, resurrection is not a new thing; it's the restoration of the creation. It is. It is fulfilling our desire for that creation, for a complete restoration, which Paul is big in 1 Corinthians 15, because he recognizes that the opposite of a fulfilled life is a futile life. The opposite of this fulfillment is vanity of vanities of Ecclesiastes. And this is why Paul says, if in this life we have only hoped in Christ, we are all people most to be pitied. And I'm afraid that so much of what the church does today is pitiable, because we spend all our time trying to show people why they should be parts of the church, because it'll make this life so much better. They'll say, see how the church needs to be a part of your life. That's not the church of the resurrection. The resurrection says, see how this life is actually good when it is placed within the story of Jesus. We don't fit the message for the world. We put the world within that message so that it can be changed and rescued from its despair. And Paul's quite clear. You can't argue with the fact that death came, and it came through an act of the man. But here's what's happened. Life now has taken place. The reversal of that death has also happened because of the one event of the crucifixion. And that I find amazing. And then Paul, in this short little passage, says the upshot of that is that Jesus will put all his enemies under his feet. Right? And before we have a chance of thinking of all the people we would like Jesus to crush, Paul makes it quite clear, the enemy he is speaking of is death. And Jesus is going to use conversion and baptism in order to turn people from enemies, and he does that by releasing them from the last enemy, death. Now, again, how do you lift that out of the realm of cliche?
I don't know if you can.
All right. So maybe we just take this recognizing that the sermon is one thing, living is another, yeah. And that we ourselves, we leave the pulpit and then have the task of living out what we have just confidently proclaimed, and being confident in that resurrection.
Thank you, David and Ethan, and thank you for listening. All the podcasts from this series, Worth Doing Badly, are available from our website, lutheranradio.co.uk. Try our app. Download it for free from Google Play or the App Store. If you have any questions or comments about this or any other program on our schedule, send me an email to manager@lutheranradio.co.uk. I am your host, Jamie Krieger, and I will be back next week with David and Ethan. Thank you again for listening, and stay on for more here on Lutheran Radio UK.